Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, welcome to another episode of How I Raised It, produced by Foundersuite.com. Today I have Scott Abel and Jennifer Falk of YouMuse coming to us from Austin, Texas. How's your day going, Jen and Scott?
Excellent.
Great.
And the craziness of South By and all the other stuff that's been going on has subsided, I assume?
I'm happy anyway. It gets a little crazy when 100,000 people descend on downtown Austin.
Yeah. Did you participate or do any events or parties for your company, or you just kind of sit and sublet or rent out your house on Airbnb, or what do you do during South By?
We had a couple kind of tactical, press meetings, but I was lucky they weren't downtown in the hubbub of everything. So we met one reporter at a barbecue place kind of in South Austin. That was nice because I got, some of the vibe without having to go through all the pain. But otherwise, no, we kind of watch it from afar, and maybe Jen rents out her house. I didn't.
Yeah. Good. Great. So what is YouMuse, and how did you come up with this idea? What's the backstory?
Yeah. So YouMuse, we started this company to try to tame the chaos in workplace communications. Our product is designed to take the power and flexibility of email, couple it with the speed and intimacy of chat, and bring both of those channels' messages together into one integrated and prioritized, almost Facebook-like feed. So you can get all your messages in one place. We apply machine learning to prioritize those messages for the ones that are most important. And we do that with the hopes that it'll streamline communication and make it easier for you to do your job every day.
So you keep your Gmail, your Slack, your other messaging channels, but it all just shows up on one screen?
Correct. Exactly correct.
Okay. Interesting.
You should come to work for us. That's well done.
Hey, I'm the master of making things. I actually went to grad school at UT, and one of my professors, great guy, Jeff Sandifer, said, explain it. Some fellow classmate was going off on some big tangent about his technology. He's like, explain it to me, in his Texas drawl, explain it to me like you'd explain it to, your 4-year-old son or your 80-year-old grandma. And I actually love when founders can synthesize things down to just the really easy to understand elements. I think that's a powerful skill. So
that must be something unique to UT. I went to UT, got my physics degree there, and I had this great, his name was Manfred Fink, and he taught Introduction to Quantum Mechanics, and he used to say in this heavy German accent, I should try to do it, but I'm not going to, I'll embarrass myself. He used to say, explain it to me like I'm your mother.
Yes.
And then we couldn't, and so he'd say it again louder and kind of yell at us. He's a very scary dude, but he's actually a very nice guy. He's listening.
Good. Interesting. So that's great. So I guess it sort of sits on top of, is it a software as a service? Is this another thing I log into and then it's aggregating all these into one screen? How's it work?
Yeah. So we built it based on user feedback. We built it as a downloadable app, but truth be told, it's kind of a hybrid cloud service. Part of the intelligence sits on your desktop. We do that so you'll have disconnected access. If you're on a plane or you lose Wi-Fi, most people are used to having mail or chat-like applications want to be able to have that disconnected access. But you captured it perfectly. You just log in to YouMuse. We store those credentials, log you into your Gmail account, your Slack account, whatever it might be, and we pull all those messages together into that integrated stream.
Gotcha. And how did you come up with this? Was it just a personal itch that you were scratching of, overload of different messaging platforms, or was there something else?
It was. It a little bit. It is kind of a long journey. It started almost 12 years ago when I started my last company. You've probably been through this yourself because you've started your own. You always have this entrepreneurial, one part is what product you're going to build for the outside, but then you always have this list of, you know, when I start my company, I'm going to do these things differently and smarter. And so we had a bunch of those at my last company, and some of them were tools we wanted to use or not use. And of course, we started on email. It got started in 2006. That's what you had. But over the next 10 years, all kinds of other messaging products crept in. You know, first there were some of the project management tools like Asana or Basecamp. And then, you know, things like HipChat and Slack showed up. And so 10 years later, when we have 400 employees, I'm getting hundreds and hundreds of messages a day, and I'm checking three or four different applications, and it just seemed asinine. And there's no end in sight, right? More apps are coming out, more services are coming out, chat's becoming more prevalent, and so we thought somebody needs to tackle this. Now, why we thought it should be us, I don't know. It is quite the problem, but that was the motivation. It was very personal for all three of us.
Yeah, I find my day, and it's pretty annoying. I guess it's effective in some ways, but it's pretty annoying. I'm being constantly pinged by the intercom chirp and, of course, the email chime, and then, you know, a few other things here and there. But it's like I'm like a trained trained dog or something, right? Trained by the Pavlovian bell to respond to all these different services. They control me versus the other way around. So I get it. I get the need. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the cost of that distraction is way more than we think it is. You know, various different studies have been done, you know, and they range from every interruption costs you 3 or 4 minutes to my personal favorite, you know, an interruption costs you 5 times the switching time, right? So if I stop what I'm doing, I go over to this for 5 minutes and I want to go back to that article I'm writing, let's say, or prepping for this call, that loss in productivity, I'm going to take a 5x hit for whatever time, you know, oh, it's only 30 seconds, I'll pop over and respond to that email. But our brain shifts, and so getting back into the flow of what you were doing before is super hard to do.
Yep. And is this just a monthly subscription that I'm paying?
Well, we have an opportunity for you right now. It's 100% free. We are in that phase of the product where it's all about product market fit and making sure we have something that, you know, users truly love and solves a problem for them. So I doubt that we will get to monetization this year. But when we do monetize, we'll probably take a go-to-market model or monetization model, I should say, very similar to Slack, and they had copied some other ones. So you would think of it as a freemium model where we have a pretty rich set of features that are always free. And then we have a core set of features that might be good for bigger teams or larger enterprises. And that's how we'll eventually monetize the product.
Yep. Okay. What was your previous company? Just out of curiosity.
So the last company I was founding CEO of was called Spiceworks here in Austin.
Oh yeah.
They build kind of IT software used by about 6-7 million people a month. It's gotten to be quite large. They're actually right across the street from me. I can see them from here.
Yeah, no, I remember them well. Awesome. And did that, what was the conclusion of that? Did Spiceworks get acquired or go public? I remember them when I was at UT, but I didn't keep up with the story.
Still private, still growing. They, you know, I think maybe 13 or 14, they considered going public. That's when we took a pretty substantial investment round from Goldman Sachs, and which I did all that fundraising back then. And so that gave them a lot of runway to keep going. I think they're kind of picking the perfect time to go out. But I left almost 2 years ago now, so I'm not that involved day to day anymore.
Interesting. So I think this is a good segue. So I noticed you've raised 2 seed rounds, correct?
In UMuse?
Yes.
Yeah, just one seed round.
One seed round. Okay. I'm looking at PitchBook, and I've got Floodgate, Next Coast Ventures, and then Shasta Ventures. I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that you knew Mike Maples from previous, or maybe give the story of how you raised capital for this. And, you know, it sounds like there's some DNA. Mm-hmm.
There absolutely is. Your instincts are right. So I did know all three of those investors before I started UMuse. I felt kind of bad when I you know, was thinking about this call, and you're probably going to want to know how many did I call on, and you know, what was our hit rate and all kinds of questions like this. I was like, ooh, that's going to be kind of embarrassing, because this on number four, one of the benefits is that part's a little less hard. You know, I might have to draw on my number two or number three company experience to answer that maybe in a way that'd be more helpful for your listeners. But the connections are Ravi Mohan, Shasta Ventures, was a Series B investor in Spiceworks. Tom Ball at Next Coast Ventures, he was at Austin Ventures when they did the Series A investment in Spiceworks, so he saw Spiceworks from the very beginning. And Mike Maples at Floodgate Capital. Mike was my co-founder at the first company I was involved in that I was a founder of, which was Motive Communications here in Austin. So Mike and I go back about 20 years.
Yeah, great. Interesting. I'm going to jump around a little bit. So Next Coast Ventures, is that one of the almost mushrooms that have sprouted up from the, I don't want to call it the fall of Austin Ventures, but what do you want to call it? The transition of Austin Ventures.
It is, whatever,
right?
You call it. It absolutely is. And I think it's a good thing, too. I was a little worried, to tell you the truth, when Austin Ventures kind of, it all happened kind of, you know, quickly when things came apart there. I think they kind of been brewing slowly, just that not having anything to do with people, because it's a great set of guys there. But the dynamics of raising larger and larger funds, and it's natural for you as the general partner to go, where's the best use of that capital for the firm, meaning Austin Ventures. And they were doing more of these growth capital deals, kind of like HomeAway or RetailMeNot, which were phenomenally successful for them. And I think almost by accident, they weren't investing as many early stage startups like Spiceworks. Spiceworks was actually pretty rare in their portfolio because things had already started to drift in that direction. And so I was a little bit worried when all that happened. You know, there's Live Oak Ventures here in town. There's S3, there's Silverton, but collectively they didn't have the same pool of capital. So I was really excited when Tom Ball told me he was going to go off and try to start another fund, which they very successfully did in raising their fund.
When was that? What time frame was that?
They started, it's funny, we kind of align. Funny story, there's I don't know if you ran into him in your dealings, but there's a local real estate development company here called Hill Partners. And there's a phenomenal guy that's one of the managing partners there. His name is Dick Anderson, and he's been heavily involved in the startup community for 20 years. And all four of my companies I've incubated in a Hill Partners space. And so that's how we ended up hanging out together, Tom and I. We were both taking a conference room in Dick Anderson's space. And we'd had breakfast before this, but we were joking about the fact that we were right next to each other, and we were both kind of trying to start a company, mine a product company, his a new venture capital firm. And that was in, they first started the process in the middle of 15, and then we were both hanging out at HBI in the first quarter of 2016.
What's HBI?
That's Hill Partners.
Okay. Oh, I gotcha. Yeah, that's great. It's amazing how many of these stories just are oftentimes you got in the right elevator at the right time, or you were in the same buffet line at the right time. Yeah, it's good. So great. So I think it'd be interesting to maybe have you contrast, you know, raising money for your previous companies. Like, what was it like raising money back Spiceworks? Or you can even go further back if you want, you know, kind of how the process has changed. Give us a little, I know this wasn't on the question list, but a little history lesson in raising money for startups in Texas and how it's evolved over the years, if you can.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Let me ponder that for just a second. In some ways it's changed a lot, and in some ways not at all. I mean, the basics are still there. If I was giving somebody advice and saying, well, what's the most important thing you can do when you're raising money, it would be get to know venture capitalists before you need money from them. It's really hard to do cold start. That was true then, that's true now. And so if I knock on your door and say, hey, I'm Scott Abel, I want to raise money, and you've never heard of me, you don't have any sense for my character, what I'm made of, what my values are, forget all the stuff about my businesses and the good one and everything, it's probably not going to end well, not because you don't have a good idea or maybe a good team, just you're looking for a way to differentiate yourself from the 100 people that are here from this week. It is crushing the load those guys have. Anybody who thinks that's an easy job is probably a little bit confused. And so I don't think that's changed. And one of the things we did across all four companies is we always tried to have a how would I describe this? A unique advantage, right? We tried to cheat a little bit and break the rules. And what I mean by that is if you have to cold call a VC, you're just making your job 10 times higher. So at the beginning of my first company, Motive, it was just short of an entrepreneur in residence situation for the founding CEO. I was not that CEO, but it was, one of the co-founders. And he stacked the deck by making sure that all the co-founders Austin Ventures knew really well, and that they probably would have backed any one of them. And so from their perspective, they look at that team of five co-founders and go, wow, I put money into any one of them, and they're all together in the same team. And this was back when it was super common that you would get funded on just an idea with no product built, because 20 years ago, it was way harder to build something. And so that's what we did. And while there was a little bit of dog and pony to raise the money, round it off, it wasn't hard because Scott Harmon, who was the founding CEO, brilliantly, he kind of put these chess pieces in place way in advance. And I remember watching that because I didn't understand at the time and thinking, wow, that I should pay attention to that. That looks important.
Yeah. So to get to know VCs before raising money, which is interesting, you also mentioned that their workload and deal flow is crushing. So I guess would your advice then be to join an early company that is funded and kind of network your way in? In other words, how do you get to know VCs when they're already so busy, it's hard to find time on their schedule?
Yeah, well, I think the really good ones are looking for, smart young entrepreneurs to get to know, and they just dedicate their discipline. They dedicate a certain amount of their time to just general networking, and like Maples in particular, I think is legend for this. He would pretty much take any breakfast with any person, just because. On his side, you never know where the next cool deal is going to come from. I do think what you were alluding to is if you, let's say you graduated from college and said, I know I want to start my own company someday, the smartest thing you could do would be become a co-founder from somebody else who'd done it, or at least become one of those first 10 or 20 employees so you can watch how they do what they do. I mean, I was so lucky in my first one because I wasn't really setting out to do it, I was able to, watch professionals basically. I would have never thought to do what Scott Harmon did. It would have never entered my mind. I'm slow, but I'm not completely stupid. So watching him do it, I went, whoa, wait a minute, write that down. I might need to do that someday. And so that, your instincts are dead on. That's a great thing to do because it's just so much easier to learn by watching somebody else do it.
Scott was the CEO of Motive, is that correct? Or let me make sure.
Yes, Scott Harmon was the founding CEO of Motive.
Okay, gotcha. I just want to make sure I have my dots connected here. Good. Interesting. And when I was in school there, Austin was kind of an enterprise town. Is it still, would you say that's still the case? I would I guess I consider you guys in the enterprise space, or at least you probably will be.
I think that is a very fair assessment of Austin, you know, and I think it kind of speaks to the kind of exits you see. A lot of times I think Austin gets a bad rap. You know, people go, oh, there have been no unicorns come out of Austin, which isn't true. There have been a couple. Delt was one. Whole Foods was another. But in general, you don't see as many, because if you go look at unicorns, billion-dollar exits, they accrue disproportionately to consumer plays. And I don't think that's our expertise. We're slowly getting there. You know, Spiceworks was a, for lack of a better word, it was kind of a consumerization of the enterprise play. And if it works, UMuse will be the same. And so you are seeing pockets of that improve, but if I had to put it in the yes or no category, you know, I'd put it in the no category.
Interesting. What do you think of some of these newer entities like Capital Factory and, I've heard of a few other places like that sprouting up? Is that adding more consumer to the scene?
I don't know if it's adding more consumer expertise per se. There's Capital Factory, there's Techstars. Those are the two prominent ones in Austin, and you get a little bit of bleed over from the Y Combinators of the world on the West Coast. I think what it does do, it's a great, I know several venture guys who connect themselves with the Capital Factories and the Techstars because they can be good deal flow. The people that go through those to varying degrees are pretty serious about learning, and so that helps filter the funnel a little bit for the institutional investors. But I don't know that I have any facts to really say it's changed the distribution of our expertise here in Austin. I think the thing that would do that most, right, is it's pretty easy to get a company to kind of a 100-person, $10 million a year off of the Austin talent infrastructure. Not to suggest getting to 10 million is easy, but I mean, as far as the team you need. Mm-hmm. And then it gets kind of hard because you don't have a deep enough bench strength of, you know, executive team members who've been there and done that in your space, whichever one it is, even if it's enterprise, you know, because we just don't turn over. That's one of the advantages of the Valley, is the startup density is so high that even when you take into account 90% failure, the 10% that succeed, you know, those blossom, the seeds get planted, and it just keeps going over and over again. And so if you're looking for a VP of marketing to take you from 10 million to 100 million, there's 20 of them you can go talk to, and you got to find the right one for you. You know, there might be one or two here in Austin, and if they love their job and are kind of golden handcuffed in, I'm not getting them.
Yeah.
And that's, I think at Spiceworks, that's where we saw the biggest pain, was kind of probably post 20 million in revenue for us, but your point's the same, you get it.
Yeah, interesting. That's a good point. What other, you know, Austin is just growing so fast. Are you seeing an influx of West Coast or even East Coast talent coming in? Is it starting to infuse itself or not as much?
No, it is. I think it is. You're seeing both an infusion of talent and capital. I know, for example, Shasta Ventures, you know, one of the reasons they did the UMuse investment, clearly relationship that I already had, but also, you know, they've hired a partner, and his job is to focus at least, you know, 30-40% of his time dedicated on Austin. He's out here once or twice a quarter. You know, he connects regularly with me, either directly or indirectly through Ravi, who's the partner on my deal, and he's actively looking to make investments in Austin because they'd like a stronger presence here. I wouldn't be surprised another couple years if they opened an office here. Talent, you know, that's a little bit more liquid, no pun intended, than talent, because that's a little harder. I got to get somebody to move here. But you're seeing that, right? You read about this all the time. The Zebra here in town, their new CEO came from Excite. And he moved here from the West Coast. So that's the way it normally happens, is somebody wakes up and says, I think I'm kind of tired of the property values, the prices, traffic. Not picking on California, but it's one of the things, at least for a little while, we have to in our favor. And so they move, and we go, woohoo, there's some great talent here. Let's put them to work. We're not shy.
Every time I go to South by Southwest, we didn't go this year, but went the last couple of years, and I'll stay with my brother-in-law who lives in Austin, and I see what kind of house he bought for a certain price, and it does make you think for at least a while about should I be there instead of here. It's certainly, yeah. Plus the barbecue.
Yeah, my wife tells me, you know, because she watches the startup business from afar. She has different values, of course. So she's like, no, tell everybody Austin sucks so they won't come here.
Right.
I'm like, yeah, they're usually smart people and we'll figure it out on their own. But nice try, hunt.
Yeah. What other, if you have any top of mind, you mentioned Shasta's, you know, kind of actively scouting for deals. Any other VCs that come to mind that are kind of making a presence on the Austin scene that founders should tune into and get to know?
You know, I'm trying to think of anybody that are here regularly. Maples is obviously, because he still has family connections. His dad lives here in town, and he's here a lot. And he's always looking for early stage deals. He's primarily a seed Series A investor, but he's got a good size fund now, so that's material. I've noticed that VCs in general have been doing a better job of courting from afar, and so I'll regularly get contacted from Battery and Bessemer and NEA, and you know those are just the top of mind, because since we launched, you know, I'll get emails or phone calls from those people. Some I've known before, some even I don't, going, hey, we're, you know, they'll rattle off four investments that they have in Austin. Some I may not have even known they were in. So they're clearly paying attention and watching, right? Mm-hmm. Whether they have an office here or not. But nobody with a big physical presence in town yet.
Good. And other than Next Coast Ventures, any other, you know, local VCs, newer ones maybe, that any listeners should check out if they're trying to get up to speed on the scene?
None that I haven't mentioned already. You know, mm-hmm. We talked about Silverton and S3, Live Oak. I'm trying to think if I don't think there are really any other new ones in Austin. There's a few in Dallas that have, you know, been trying to kind of poke their nose under the tent, but I don't know how serious they are. I think that was a little bit more opportunistic.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Let's talk about you a little bit more. So it sounds like, you know, raising this seed round for UMoves was largely based on the strength of previous relationships, people betting on you. You mentioned you'll probably, you know, monetize this later this year or beyond that. When will you raise money again? How are you thinking about your own capital strategy and how will you do it?
Yeah. Now, so we purposely raised, our seed round was rather large. We raised $5 million. That always cracks me up. That's one big, to go back to your earlier question, segue, difference between, you know, 10 years ago and now. There's been this, I guess you'd call it title deflation. You know, 10 years ago, you'd have called $5 million a Series A, and somebody would have laughed at you if you called it a seed round, and now we call them seed rounds and nobody blinks. And it appears to be worsening. I saw a couple things last 30 days, you know, $10 million seed round, $15 million, I'm like choking, like, wow, that's a lot of seeds.
Yep.
But we were very careful, and we knew this space, highly competitive. Lots of people have mucked around with email and tried to fix it and failed. And I'm not delusional to think there's something magic about us that our path will be any different. That's not a lack of confidence. What we're doing is just reality. And so we really raised the amount we did on the advice of one of our investors who said, I get it. It's a high risk bet. 5% chance, I think you should take twice as much money as your plan. And we originally had only planned to take 2.5. And at the time, I was, you know, I was a little cool on the idea. And I remember the sage advice of the CFO that I worked with at Motive, who's now a good friend of mine. He said, son, whenever somebody wants to give you capital at a good price, take as much as they'll give you. He's actually British, so he sounds way cooler than me when he said it. But, he's cringing right now when he's listening to this. But and so I thought, wow, you know, he's probably seen some movie before where they got close and then I ran out of capital and that would be bad. In hindsight, I think I've told him at least one dozen times, thank you, because we would be out of money if that's what we had done. This is a long-winded way of saying we'll probably raise money near the end of this year. You know, we'll probably do a proper Series A, which is really a Series B in my book. You know, that's the we really are more at a Series A phase. If you look at what we've done until we launched our public beta, we were materially working on alpha code when it came not so much to stability, but the quality of the features, what we knew you would need to do your job. And so if you looked at the stage of the company, you would probably get to that point on seed funding. And then a Series A is what would kind of finalize product market fit and then take you to you know, monetization or the beginnings of it, at which case that's normally, at least in the old days, how you'd raise a Series B. So phase-wise, we're about in that place. Amount of capital, you know, probably a big range, but 5 to 10. It depends a little bit on what we learn over the next 90 to 120 days. Probably closer to 10 than 5.
And do you think, obviously, won't hold you to this, but do you stay in Austin for that? Do you go West Coast, or do you put together kind of a syndicate of East Coast, West Coast, and some Austin money? I don't know. How do you think about kind of putting together that round?
You know, we'll absolutely have to go, you know, west or east. Most likely for me, probably West Coast, because I know more VCs out there. You know, I think our challenge will be less the traditional, you know, team as a, are you a good person to back, and just more, it's a little bit of a crazy idea, and there's product market risk there that somebody's going to have to stomach. And, you know, so you never... or rarely can you hit on all cylinders, but I think that'll be the bigger challenge for us, is helping somebody understand what risk we've removed, how much we have left to go, but I don't think we'll have a huge question around, you know, the team, or do we know how to go execute should they choose to invest.
And you don't have to give the exact number, but do you have kind of a total user base or growth rate in mind that will tell you when it's time to go raise this Series A? Are you kind of thinking of it like that, or is it more just, you know, when you feel the time is right to go raise, it'll be time? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, it's a good question, actually, because you're always, what makes startups fun and challenging is you're always juggling this set of balls that feels like that you can't ever hold enough of them, right? I mean, like you can't ever quite pin the animal down. You push on it here, it squirts out there, and you're like, how am I supposed to make this equation work? But that's your job, so quit, you know, I need to quit whining about it and just do it. And so for us, we approached it a little bit more simplistically and just said, we're going to manage those other things like user growth, I'll come back to that in a second, and just look at time. Right, so we know exactly what our burn rate is. We know when we run out of capital, I back up from that 6 months. I never want to be in market raising money with less than that. That would be one of my advice to anybody raising money.
Sorry, what was that? 6 months of runway? What was the number?
Yeah, so I always try. My floor is never be in market with less than 6 months of cash in the bank. Mm-hmm. Because if you do find somebody you like, it's just... they're not being bad people. It's just human nature. If you have 2 months left, they're probably going to drag their feet a little bit and see how desperate you get.
Sure.
And then you got to go get a bridge loan, and that, you know, it's just easier to say, all right, I'm not going to let more than 6 months go by before, or excuse me, have 6 months left before I go raise it.
What other heuristics? 6 months of runway, a certain growth level, a certain product market fit proof point. What else?
Yeah, so that I think that one's really variable by the space, right? By the market and the product you're building, and it depends. There are some, like if you were building a consumer application and it's practically done, and meaning it works, it's out in the market, and you're not, you know, adding hundreds of thousands of users a week at least, if not a day. Pure consumer application. I'm not talking about a hybrid like Slack or something like that. You're probably not raising money, period, right? So there are these kind of yardsticks that I think the industry, not just VCs, uses to kind of gauge adoption of a product, and that's clearly one of them. At Spiceworks, for example, it was different. The numbers were two order of magnitude smaller, but the market was two orders of magnitude smaller. So I computed one time that we actually grew faster in our market than Facebook grew in theirs, because there's, you know, 2 billion people on the planet that could use Facebook. Well, I didn't have that. There weren't 2 billion IT pros on the planet. But of the, you know, 6 or 7 million, we were adding about 1,200 new users a day. It's probably higher than that now, I'm sure. And so, you know, when you do the math, we actually gobbled up a little bit more of the market every day than, say, Facebook did. And so that's one thing you can do as an entrepreneur, right? I would go into, when we raised our Series B, which was a more traditional, none of the investors I knew personally, I got introductions from Austin Ventures. It wasn't a cold call, but I didn't know them. They didn't know me. And so that's one of the things you're doing, is trying to help them, you know, triangulate what does this mean in your space to what I'm used to. And sometimes that works in your favor, and sometimes it doesn't work in your favor. You know, for us, because Spiceworks started as this enterprise app that made money through advertising that ran in the app, that was just heresy at the time. And nobody had ever done it before. And so if you had a consumer internet investor in the room, on the back of a napkin, he could tell you that business model was never going to work. And it's because he could do the simple math and say, if you want to get to 100 million in revenue, you got to be doing billions of impressions every month, because you get $3 CPM, click, 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 you'll never be that big. There aren't enough people in the IT space. And they would be right, except that when a user's in Spiceworks doing their job, they'll generate like 200 or 300 times the impressions, right? And so, yeah. And we didn't even know that. And so all of those people passed but one, which was Shasta Ventures, because they weren't looking at monetization. They were just looking at, do you have a product that's immensely valuable to the target user? And if you do, I bet you'll figure out a way to make money on it. So they were very insightful.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting how this consumerization of enterprise probably forces people to change how they think about startups, right? Kind of thinking about enterprise startups like consumer plays in some ways. I don't know if there's a question there. So leading up to this next round, just one or two more questions, I'll let you get back to it. Leading up to this next round, you know, what I'm sure you'll lean on Floodgate and Shasta to populate your funnel with some leads. What else will you do in advance of getting out there? Will you run a roadshow? Will you, you know, how will you kind of approach it?
I don't know that anybody loves fundraising, and I would not be different than anybody else. I don't really love it. It's massively distracting. You know, you got to do it. It's important for the company. Obviously, you need the capital to try to do what you're going to do and to grow. But if I said, oh, would you love to spend 8 weeks of your life knocking on 50 doors and 49 of them tell you no, pound sand.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe there's a masochist out there that's really into that, but I'm not. And so I try to cheat whenever I can, right? I try to stack the deck in my favor. And so I try to that's one reason, even though I'm not by nature a super social dude, I will get out. I try to cultivate those relationships well in advance. So the first time I call somebody, they're not hearing, you know, our story from scratch. There are ways that you can leverage your current investors to kind of nudge somebody or help you figure out the ones that are inclined at your stage or you're part of the market or you're part of the industry if they're thematically based. But eventually it comes down to you're going to have to go see a set of people and pitch the company. And that's when it's, I think, your storytelling skills really come into play. It's so many people, you know, they think if I just tell them the facts, then it'll be self-evident and they'll give me the money. And rarely is that the case. You know, mm-hmm. I think the best fundraisers are the best storytellers. I don't mean as in line, yep. But I mean, you know, being able to your point, simply explain something to somebody, have them get the impact it should have. And, you know, like, here's an interesting anecdote from our first round. Even though I knew these people and rounded off on a phone call, they said we'd invest. We did all the work we would do if they were strangers, right? Put together a full deck, worked hard on it, you know, what problem is it? How are we solving it? You know, how big is the market? What's our go-to-market? What's the 18-month operating plan? We probably didn't have to do that. Well, I know we didn't have to do it because I never got past slide 3. Nobody ever looked at it. I think one of them said after the round closed, hey, could you send me that pitch deck? We like to keep them on file.
Mm-hmm.
but I think it would have been bad form and bad discipline to assume that was going to work, because you, half of doing that has nothing to do with raising money. It's a forcing function to make you to understand where you really are, what's really working, what's not, how are you going to attack it. Sometimes you just need those external events to push you forward. And fundraising, you know, because it's kind of binary, it's kind of a no BS way to have to look in the mirror and say what's really working and what's not.
Yeah, that's great. I like that. Let's conclude on that. I guess for anyone who's interested in learning more, it's umuse.io, correct? Do I have that right?
Correct. Yep. You can go to umuse.io and you'll see a quick summary of what the product does and a nice big download button. Please give it a try.
Great. And it's free for the foreseeable immediate future, which is exciting. Any other call to action you'd like to make to the audience?
No, well, you know, maybe if you listen to this and it's about 2 weeks from now, we'll be out on Product Hunt, so go check it out there as well.
Okay, awesome. Well, that'll be exciting. Good luck. Yeah, we've launched a few things on Product Hunt. It's kind of a fun, wild ride for 14 hours, and then the next day or two after are kind of fun too. So good luck. I'll be on the outlook for that. I'll definitely upvote you in comments. So.
Thank you.
All right, Scott and Jen, thank you very much. Maybe we'll catch you after your next round. It'd be fun to hear kind of contrast and compare the postscript with this story. So
we'd love to do it. Thanks so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
All right, thanks, guys. Bye.
Take care.